Okay. So I thought just to begin with, and maybe this will give people who just came a chance to catch up a little, if there's any questions that you had from last time or from reading, you can have a chance to ask. Yes. What's your name? Christine.
I had started the required reading, and there was one. I did have a question about written by Lama Yeshe, the ocean.
Make your mind an ocean, something like that?
Becoming your own therapist.
Oh, becoming your own therapist.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Are we to read the entire 115-page book or just the section?
I'll leave that to Mr. Watkins.
I was going to pass out the list of readings at the end, but if you go to the website and look at the readings, there's the required readings, which are quite short. Then there's the wish-fulfilling golden sun. Read that. The becoming your own therapist and mind like an ocean are optional, and you don't have to read those for this class. Okay?
Mm-hmm. You can, if the other people have questions, this gentleman is going to be the microphone man. Anyone else have something they want to ask? Okay. So, we're sort of introducing one of the essential elements of Buddhist understanding, the mind. The mind. So, from a Buddhist perspective, the mind, what we're talking about is the mental consciousness, right? Not the eye, ear, nose, taste, or touch. In the West, sometimes people talk about someone has a sixth sense. Wasn't there some movies a couple of years ago? Little Boy or something. Almost as though the sixth sense is something that not everyone has. What do you think? Do you have a sixth sense besides eye, ear, nose, taste, and tongue? What do you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think? Gut. Okay. Well, from Buddhist perspective, it's a little more precise than that. Although there is that also. We say the mental consciousness. The mental consciousness is that entity which is knowing right now, which is listening, which is analogy I like to give is a little bit like this. The eye consciousness, ear, nose, tongue, and tactile consciousnesses are simply receptive, kind of like the cameras that you find, the surveillance cameras you find at the various, you know, the entrance, the back door, you know, and there's a guard in some little room, a guy or a gal, looking at the five monitors, let's say. Those monitors themselves don't do any thinking. It's the guard who's looking at them who is going to make some decision depending on what those monitors are providing, the information that they're providing. The guard is going to initiate some kind of response, right, or either help or call for guards or something. Do you understand what I'm saying, right? So like that, the mental consciousness is something within us which is observant of the senses, but it is observing them. It is a separate, it has its own separate continuity, and it is separate arisal. Say, for instance, your mind, you can still be thinking when your eyes are closed and you don't have any input to your eye consciousness. Or if you happened, as you're getting older, like some of us, if you were to become totally deaf and blind, you could still be thinking. That thinking takes place in your mental consciousness. Your mental consciousness is like that fellow or gal in the room looking at the eye, what the eyes are seeing, what the ears are hearing, nose, tongue, tactile are perceiving. Those senses, the other senses, are consciousness also, sense consciousnesses, But the mental consciousness is a sixth consciousness, or sixth sense, if you will. And it's within that that we meditate, that we remember, that we plan, that we make judgments about the future. Our eyes might see an attractive dress in the window. And the mental consciousness upon, like the guard seeing that input, would make judgments about it. Oh, that's nice. Oh, I wonder if that would look nice on me, and you know, make plans and so forth. It's our mental consciousness that gives us the problems also. It's the mental consciousness that gets angry. Do you get angry in your eye consciousness? Your tongue? Yeah, I mean, maybe you if you touch a hot plate, and you say, oh, darn, you know, you might feel like your hand got angry, but it's not that. Your hand received some information. It's actually perceiving, in that case, not smoothness or roughness, but actually heat. And your mental consciousness would be the one that's motivating you to say some expletive. Darn, or worse than that. Okay? The mental consciousness continues throughout our day while we're awake. At the time of sleep, when we go to sleep, the sense consciousness and the mental consciousness begin to withdraw away from their bases. Well, in the case of the senses, the eye consciousness begins to withdraw away from the eye organs toward the center of the chest, as does subsequently the ear consciousness, the nose, tongue, and tactile consciousness. And you'll still have, finally, a little bit of mental consciousness, maybe thinking. Have you ever in that kind of dreamy state where you're still thinking, but... There you go. Bad connection. When you're falling asleep, the sense that you can't... Maybe you don't see anything. You're not seeing things as clearly, or even if someone says something, you're kind of, what? You know, you're... Ear consciousness that had kind of withdrawn. The mental consciousness finally also, at the time of sleep, withdraws into a depth of our body, not to the brain. The mental consciousness is not only related with our brain, although Western science would tend to think, would tell us that it, according to their experiments, it's very much related with the brain, but perhaps that's more short-term memory. The mental consciousness may even, when you're in deep sleep, disappear for a while in a dormant state, but there's still a consciousness that continues, a subtle consciousness that we may have made allusion to last time. Was it in this class we talked about that, or was that another class? Very briefly. What we're experiencing right now, from moment to moment, is a continuity of our consciousness. And when I'm talking about consciousness now, I'm going to mainly mean the mental consciousness. The consciousness that you have right now is not the same as the consciousness you had at 9 o'clock this morning, if you were conscious at 9 o'clock this morning. You might still have been in bed, I don't know. But if you were awake at that time, that consciousness is not exactly the same. You were thinking different things at that moment, different perceptions than the consciousness right now. But they are connected by a continuity, like a stream. So we say the stream of consciousness, continuity of consciousness. At the time of sleep, where does the stream of consciousness go? The gross consciousness, this consciousness that we're experiencing right now through our senses and our mental consciousness, they both absorb into a location in our body where a very subtle mind, very subtle consciousness is continuing. That's why when we wake up from sleep again, these things dawn. They sort of absorb from the center of the chest to the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, tactile and so forth, and you again, you know, you again have these senses. At the time of death, the subtlemost consciousness leaves this body. There's still a continuity of consciousness, but it's not a consciousness that thinks, you know, I am Robbie Watkins, I am Annie, I am Diane, I am Jim, I am George. It doesn't have any identification with this lifetime or any personality at that time. And depending on our fortune, or we would say our karma. You've heard the word karma before? We mentioned that last time, didn't we? I told you the story about the bumper sticker. My karma ran, your karma ran over my dogma. Right? After this lifetime, there is a continuity of consciousness that will manifest again, according to our fortune or our karma, in another rebirth. Sometimes as a human, sometimes as an animal, sometimes as a more ethereal kind of existence, what through history has been called godlike experiences, not God with a capital G, but, you know, like the Greek gods or the Roman gods, the Indian gods. We could experience also the stream of consciousness like a nightmare. We could experience a hellish-like experience, which the traditional religions of the world, I think in general, most religions talk about a possibility after this life of experience of hell, right? Is there some religion you know of that doesn't take cognizance of a possibility of a hell existence after this? There are some? What would you... Oh, Jehovah Witnesses don't believe in hell. That's good for them. Okay. What were you going to say?
I'm not sure about Judaism.
Yeah, Judaism also, there's, in my mind also, I'm not trained in Judaism, I don't know, but I understand there's some, it's,
yeah.
The doctrine is not exactly clear what happens. But what I wanted to offer to you here is a Buddhist perspective about the continuity of consciousness. Our consciousness is not limited to this life alone. Our gross consciousness right now, the one that thinks, I am Kirsten, or I am Caroline, or I am Steve, or, you know, whatever. That consciousness will absorb at the time of sleep and at the time of death in a total way, and a subtle continuity of consciousness will continue. That subtle consciousness will then again evolve, will or devolve into a gross consciousness in another life. You might think, I'm a cockroach, you know, I'm a cow, I'm a god, I'm in hell, I'm an animal. Or if we're fortunate from a spiritual point of view, I'm a human. You wouldn't necessarily be thinking those words, but just you would recognize, I am this. You would have some body and some gross consciousness that has evolved from that subtle consciousness. So there's a continuity, a line, a stream of consciousness that will continue in the future. Likewise, there was consciousness in the past. Before we were born, our mind existed also, not in some primordial state, but as another life. We have been, in the past, humans. We have been animals. We've been gods. We've been ghosts. We've been hell beings. But we've never gotten out of this circle game. I wanted to give a course one night. That was one of my daydreams, to give a course at some liberal college in New York, like with the New School of Social Research, with every time there would be a music like Joni Mitchell's The Circle Game or something like that, trying to relate it to Buddhism. The Circle Game. We're from life to life, our continuity of consciousness, depending on our practice, depending on our behavior, we will experience different kinds of lives. It is possible through developing the mind in a very acute way, with very deep concentration, to recall in your mind, in your mental consciousness, your past lives. I think very rare, the kind of things that you read about people remembering their past lives, like who is it, Shirley MacLaine, or these kind of things. That's, they're making use of, maybe they believe these things. Some people believe, some people are making money. But in general, it's not something that's easy or that you can simply be hypnotized or, you know, someone has you do some breathing meditation and you can remember authentically and clearly your past lives. Maybe that's a bit stretching it. But it is possible. At the time of the Buddha, when the monastics had the opportunity to spend their whole life in a very intense practice, that they developed single-pointed concentration with their mind, their mental consciousness, and through regressing, going back over the events of the day, and this might be an interesting exercise for you to try, because this is an actual method you can use if you had single-pointed concentration to remember your past lives. You would begin from now and think, well, let's see, 20 minutes ago I was outside putting on my robe. Before that, I was talking to the folks at the cash register. Before that, we were in the car driving from Robbie's house. Before that, we were at Robbie's house. Before that, I was taking a walk, blah, 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 all the way to this morning, to the first thought this morning, sort of playing the events of the day backwards in your mind, like a reel of a film, the continuity of the events. Every single moment of our consciousness has had a preceding moment, which was its, what do you say, substantial cause. That was the main cause of the next instant of consciousness. And if we go back, we can go back and look at the previous moments of consciousness. Till the first thought this morning. Where did that arise from? You know, you arose from sleep. There might have been some moments of dream. Let's leave those for a second. From that first moment of thought, you can make the jump to the last thought you had last night, even though there's a gap. Right? You following me? And then you can, this is an incredibly useful exercise also. You can begin to go over the events of yesterday. There may be bigger gaps of time that you don't remember what you did yesterday. Maybe you don't remember a thing you did yesterday, especially on Sunday morning. Just joking. And you can go back to the day before that, the day. Maybe you have to then begin to get to the point where you can't remember particular days. You have to think, last week, where was I? Okay, I was still here. You get some general remembrance of what happened that week. Go back the week before that. There may come times when you can't just go to weeks. You have to jump to months. What was I doing last July? What was I doing in February? At a certain point, you might have to jump years. What was I doing back in, 84? I don't know. Right now. I'd have to sort of think about it. Go back in continuity. But over time, if you had perfect concentration, you would be able to go over that stream of consciousness, the continuity of consciousness, to the first moment of thought this life. The same way that we can think now about the first moment of consciousness this morning. Do you see the parallel? And then you can make, if you have very good concentration, perfect concentration, you can make the jump to the last thought of last life. Do you understand? And right now, if you were to just do a casual thinking about the events today, go back, 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 12, had lunch, breakfast, first thought of the morning. Can you remember sort of the last thing you were thinking about last night? You can? You can't? Okay, I can't. Anyone? Some people can. Is it possible that you're completely deluded? No, I mean in the sense that... No offense. Not possible. In the sense that if I were to say, no, you didn't think about that. That's just your imagination. You say, no, there's so much consistency. I know the events of my life. I know what I thought yesterday. I can remember them. There's consistency. I remember writing something on my pad. I wrote an email, or I watched this TV program that now I can see the review of. There's all sorts of consistencies in our life that we know. We're certain about the events of yesterday. Okay? In the same way, the memories in this way of past lives come about in a similar kind of certainty. It's not as though like this, oh yes, I was King Tut. So many of these, you know, the people that I was, who was the other one? Napoleon or Cleopatra, you know, all of these imaginations that are not verified by any kinds of other events. So from a Buddhist perspective, we have a continuity of consciousness. Sometimes it's in a gross form when we're in embodied, always with a stream of subtle consciousness at its core. And at the time of sleep, the gross consciousness absorbs. At the time of awakening, it evolves again. At the time of death, it completely absorbs to the subtle consciousness, that stream of which continues, and then we're finding another consciousness in another life like that. So this is what we're working with, this stream of consciousness. And the particular phenomenon that people sometimes call rebirth or reincarnation. What does reincarnation mean? To have meet again, right? I always like in Italian, meet is carne, right? Reincarnation, re-meeting. I think it's very good, if you want to be vegetarian, it's very good to learn some German, because I understand in German, you know what the word for meat is in German?
Fleisch.
Yeah. It really gets to, you know, I want a pound of flesh. It really makes you realize that it's come from some sentient being, you know, when you use that word. So one of the words that's used is reincarnation. That means when you know, let's say, right, this is George's mind right now, sleeping, waking, you know. Later, at a certain point, the gross mind is going to absorb, and there will no longer a sense of George. The subtle consciousness, the stream of consciousness will continue, and then maybe I'm born in hell, or as a dog, or something, and there's a consciousness that, what's the opposite of absorb, radiates from that through the new body, taking rebirth as an animal, let's say, or as some other being. Right now, we have an incredible opportunity, incredibly rare opportunity from a Buddhist perspective, to be born as human and have the ability to evaluate this situation. It's in the kind of evaluation that you find in many spiritual traditions. What should I do with this life? Should I just eat, drink, and be merry, or... What was the famous Janis Joplin? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Grab as much gusto as you can. Or is there something more that you can do with this life? Well, from this perspective, you see, we're continuing from the past. We're going into the future without control. And our future is very much under the influence of our actions right now, how we act, how we behave. If we start to develop good heart, patience, and many of you, even coming here, probably are, you know, very good people. You know, thanks. Okay. When I said thanks, I said good people. She said thanks. That's great. Thanks. But can we be? Do we have? Can we see into the future whether we will, you know, what we'll experience in the future? From a Buddhist perspective, all of this continuity, until we've refined our mind in a very special way, until we become a highly realized spiritual being, this is what we call cyclic existence. Did you use the word samsara in the books? In the readings?
Yes.
Yeah. Samsara is an Indian word that refers to this taking of rebirth again and again without control. That's the main thing, samsara. Taking rebirth again and again without control. This continuity of consciousness. There was, at the monastery where I became a monk, there were toilets from the old days for the Sangha where their residence was. There were two, there was a men's and women's. One was Sam, and it was labeled Sam. The other one was Sarah, to remind people of samsara. So when we meditate, what we're meditating with is our mental consciousness, the stream of consciousness. We can as though perfume it by infusing it with good thoughts. And as a result of that, in the future, there'll be imprints on that consciousness which will bring about beneficial conditions for us, even while we're in samsara, even though we're not yet out of this circle. But we can also develop our consciousness in such a way that we no longer are under the influence of the vagaries of our past actions, you know, our karma. Even you're a very good person. We know there are books that are written, I think bestsellers in the New York Times, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Have you seen some kind of things like that, right? Why does that happen? Also, it's one of the great philosophical questions of Christianity. Why does God punish people that are good? And of course, within Christianity, at least that's what little I know of Christianity, there are ways to think about that. That's God giving you a chance to learn what other words are used? Learn or to become a better person. It's some test of God's or something. For some people, doesn't resonate with their mind, right? Other people find that convincing. From a Buddhist perspective, we have a different point of view. We think about the vagaries of life as a result of our past actions, our past karma. Once when His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who is one of our teachers, great being. Have anyone never heard of the Dalai Lama? You've heard of him. Right, but no one's not heard of him. Okay, he was in England, leaving the airport. He had met with the Archbishop of Canterbury, who I believe is the head of the Church of England, right? Some years ago, and the reporters, you know, the English reporters, trying to get some juicy tidbit here. Hey, what do you think about God? They ask him, because Buddhism doesn't believe in a creator God. You know, that we believe that there are the Buddha, the omniscient mind exists and so forth, but that the Buddha doesn't create our happiness and suffering. The Buddha shows the way to escape from this. So they said, what do you think about God? And the Dalai Lama said, God is your problem. Karma is mine. And it wasn't just putting them down. He's just saying, you know, two different philosophical stances to explain happiness and suffering in terms of the Creator God. Our minds can become enlightened. We can get to the point where we are totally blissful, totally in control, totally knowledgeable. We can become omniscient. We can become Buddhas. That's not something that usually is said in the peoples of the book, or the Abrahamic religions, right? Did I mention this before? If a little child, if you ask a little Christian child, or Jewish child, or Muslim child, what do you want to be when they grow up? And if they say, I want to be God, everyone would be, you know, oh, shut up. Don't say that. What would you call it? That's blasphemy, right? Because God is someone different than us. We're cut off. We can't become God. From a Buddhist perspective, we can become enlightened. We can become Buddha. In fact, we will become Buddha. Each and every one of us will become a Buddha sometime. In my case, it's going to be a long, long time from now. But the speed at which we achieve that, or even semblance of that, an enlightened mind, you know, more noble behavior, depends upon how we treat this continuity of consciousness. Okay. Now, how about this consciousness? Let's take a moment, sit with me for a moment, and we'll meditate a little bit. Sit comfortably with your spine straight, vertical, erect. Relax your body, relax your mind. And begin simply by counting mentally 7 respirations. Just observing them. Don't go like this. Just watch your normal breathing. To the exclusion of all other thoughts. Realize when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out, and mentally count that set of an inhalation and exhalation as one number. If you notice your mind putting some of its attention into other thoughts that are coming, just withdraw that attention away from those thoughts, back to your breathing. Invest it back into that central observation. One inhalation up your nostrils as though it was going up to the crown of your head, to your throat, to the center of your chest, in the middle, not to your lungs. And just leave your attention there. Let go of watching your breathing. And just watch your mental consciousness. There may be images, voices, conversation, either amorphous or definite emotive states, like clouds in the sky, in the space of your mind. It said that this continuity of consciousness has a nature of what's called clear light that you can begin to get an intuition of right now. By watching the contents, first of all, the thoughts. In between the thoughts, there'll be moments of quiet when you can almost sense that space-like quality of the mind. The mind is not only luminous or spacious like this, but it has the capacity to know or cognize, to experience. So there's two elements. The mind is that which is clear and knowing. Clear light, nature, its function is to perceive, know that which arises within that spaciousness of the mind. When thoughts are, when there's a little space between the thoughts, try to focus on that, like you were focusing on the breathing before, to the exclusion of everything else. And see if you can extend the time in which that spaciousness appears to your mind, where there's that clarity unobscured by other thoughts. Putting a wedge into the constant chatter of your mind, slowing it down, just watching that space. Even when the thoughts are coming rapidly, whether they be images or verbal, inner conversation or thinking, or emotional states, all of these, like clouds in a space, in a sky, are arising within the spaciousness of our mind. But simply turning your attention away from the objective thoughts to the subjective mind within which they're arising, focusing on it, the chatter of thoughts begins to diminish. Try this for another minute. Even the sense of your body appearing to your mind is like another cloud in this clear light nature of your mind. You don't have to pay attention to that body that seems to be so obviously present. Let go of your attention to that. Even let go of your sense of your ego, the observer, which might be another step more subtle. That too is just appearing to your mind as an object within the consciousness, like a cloud. Simply shift your attention to the spaciousness of the mind within which that thought is arising. Dive into the spaciousness of your mind, the clear light nature of your mind. you always have this with you, this clear light nature. It's your inner resource, your potential to be able to grow, to give birth to good states of mind within it, and to train to eliminate from its spaciousness all the bad states of mind, our anger, our jealousy, our lust, our discontent, our pride. And slowly relax, bring your attention back to the waking state, right here. Were you distressed? Oh, okay, I thought you were... Was it okay?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyone have an observation or comment? Yeah, good. I was thinking because you just said you didn't... tell me. What's your name?
My name's Danny.
Danny, oh, that's right. I remember from last time.
I was curious as if that the particular practice seems like... That particular meditation you just led, is it... This isn't really an observation of what we just did, but is that is it typical to go from shamatha into vipassana like that, of just like watching the mind instead of just focusing directly on the breath, or
this is the kind of meditation that is we can take various objects as our object of concentration of shamatha, as you call it, tranquil abiding meditation, the concentration. So one could be the breathing. And from the point of view of more deep training, the breathing is a very preliminary kind of thing, because by watching the breathing, you can begin to cause the thoughts in your mind to quiet down, and you can be left in a quiet state. But then you need to have another object afterwards to concentrate on. One of the most skillful ones, and quite advanced one, is this clear light nature of the mind. Now, I remember, Danny, right?
Yeah.
You were telling me that you studied what, Kagyu tradition?
Yeah, Jigyu Kagyu.
Yeah. So you've heard the term Mahamudra. This would be.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know, this is somewhat similar to that. Anyway, that's, Danny and I will pursue this later. We're still at another...
The follow-up that I had with that is...
The news conference.
When we're observing the clear light of the mind, is it okay to use the breath as a foundation to go back to when you lose your focus?
If you lose focus on that clarity, you could go back to the breathing at the beginning, but after some time, as you get familiar with the mind, there may be periods when you get some sense of the clarity of the mind, and then other thoughts begin to intervene, right? And it seems like I can't find the clarity again. I remember one of our Italian students was talking to my teacher, Lama Yeshe, many years ago in Italy, and it was during some course, and Lama said, "How is your clear light meditation going?" And this monk at the time, he said, "Oh, Lama, there's so many thoughts going through my mind, I can't concentrate on the clear light." Is there anyone Italian here? I don't mean to be... I'm not... What is it called when you make fun of some dialects? I'm doing... It's okay. Okay. It's okay. Lama said, that's the best time you can see the clear light, because if you've trained, you can begin to realize that even when the thoughts are there, they are within the spaciousness of the mind. Simply by taking your attention away from the individual thoughts to the substratum of the mind, the spaciousness of the mind within which they're arising, in an instant, you can be left in a calm state. They may still sort of flash back if you've got constant thoughts, but as you begin to put more effort onto the clear light nature of your mind, the frequency, first of all, the intensity of those thoughts will begin to diminish, like clouds thinning in the sky. And the frequency at which some dynamic thought, you know, reminding you to do this or that is coming into your mind, that begins to diminish. And you can be left in a with a continuity of concentration on the clear light nature. Does that make some sense?
Thank you.
Did you have a... say, for instance, a good example of this is like an aquarium. Do we have an aquarium in Raleigh area? Big, you know, with glass wall out on the coast. You don't have something to see in town?
Yeah.
In the Science Museum? Okay, so if you get a chance, does it cost anything to go to the Science Museum?
No.
Go to the Science Museum sometime. Stand there. Is it a glass wall? On the other side of the wall is water and fish, right? I take it. Or some kind of animal. So if you sit, stand there, say we're standing before that and I'm with Dr. Watkins, and I say, and Dr. Watkins says, look at the clear water. Look at the clarity of the water. And I, because of the fact the water is clear, it's not something you can perceive immediately, right? And I say, what water? And he says, well, look at the fish. You see the fish? Those are obvious, right? That are, obscure or opaque. And then he says, look between the fish. Ah, I see. It's a little bit like that. The book that one of you were asking about, Make Your Mind an Ocean, or that Dr. Watkins was referring to, this is like this kind of meditation on the clear light, using this analogy of the mind. Another analogy besides space is like an ocean. Our mind is like this clear water within which there are different thoughts coming, you know, barracudas sometime, beautiful golden, what is it, guppies, and beautiful tropical fish. Some things that are coming and going, some things that are often there that give the general tenor, like almost like the seaweed and the stones that are on the floor of the aquarium that are generally there. But if you concentrate, you can begin to see that even though the thought is there for an instant, it came through the space of the aquarium, through the water, the clarity of the water. Do you see the analogy I'm making here? In the same way, as you begin to get familiar with the various analogies, whether it be space obscured by clouds occasionally, or birds and other things, you know, flying, the vultures, bad thoughts coming through your mind, or beautiful little canaries, or beautiful things coming through your mind. As you get familiar with that example or the example of the aquarium, you can begin to recognize the thoughts in your mind as arising adventitiously. Do you know that word? That's not a normal, everyday truck driver word, right? Do you know what adventitious means? Who wants to make a stab? What does adventitious mean?
Not advantageous.
Not advantageous, adventitious. Oh, that is not advantageous. This young lady thinks she knows.
Means there's a chance and you take it, sort of. It just takes, it's kind of like taking advantage. It has an opening. That's the way I kind of read
okay.
it.
Okay. This lady back here, were you going to say? Or you're just doing your hair? Were you hip? Yeah.
Without reason, without sound, it's just there.
Oh, okay. I think you should go back home and look up adventitious tonight in the dish. Oh, she's going to look up right now. Adventitious generally means something that arises occasionally due to other causes and conditions. You know, adventitious. We say, in Buddhism, although Buddhism wasn't based on English, there's a word that can be translated as adventitious. We say the stains in our mind are not there permanently. They're adventitious stains. They can be removed from our mind. Our delusions, our anger, our attachment, they are not part and parcel of the clear light nature of our mind. That's very important to have an experience of. If you can have an experience of that in meditation, you can become a spiritual person because you have the courage to realize whatever is arising is not going to always be there. I'm not a bad person. I'm not always the cleverest person in the room if pride rises and so forth. These ordinary mundane minds arise adventitiously. Did you find adventitious? Did you look in the dictionary? Oh, yeah, I thought you were looking on. No, yeah, I think in the, yes.
Yes, it's happening in the lecture.
Oh, you looked it up. Good for you. Okay, this is a technical guy. Okay.
It means happening or carry on according to chance rather than design or inherent nature.
Happening or occurring according to chance or?
Rather than design or inherent nature.
Or rather than being on deciding on his...
designed or inherent nature. It's not working.
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah. Okay. So here it's from a Buddhist perspective, you might say chance, but the delusions are the afflicted states of mind, the problematic minds, anger, attachment. What else is problematic?
Depression.
Depression. Low self-esteem. What do you say generally?
Worry.
Jealousy. Guilt. Oh, good. We're gonna get a good list there. Hey, this crowd knows. Narcissism. That came from Danny, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay. All of these kind of problematic minds and their offshoots are adventitious. They come about because of causes and conditions. They are not part and parcel of our mind, of the clear light nature of our mind. They're not the nature of our mind, like that definition. What's your name that read the definition?
John.
Like as he read. And especially, you know, when the subtlemost mind, when we go to sleep, that subtlemost mind doesn't have any manifestation of these problematic minds. In our next life, there'll be other problematic minds that will arise. One of the aims of Buddhism is to get rid of these afflictive states and replace them with really positive states of mind, like love, compassion, wisdom, patience, contentment, satisfaction. Is satisfaction a good thing? Generally, we think, or does that sound, you know, to be content? Almost for some people, they might think that sounds too wishy-washy. They want to have the real, you know, not just contentment, they want fluorescent, you know, bliss and everything, right? When I was a boy, my brother and I and my dad used to go to the barber shop near us. I think it was Tony, not surprising, Tony's barber shop is Chicago after all. And there was a men's magazine there called Dare. And there was a picture of Teddy Roosevelt on the cover with this famous, do you know the famous quotation? No, not that one. Far better it is to fight mighty battles, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered with failure, than it is to hold rank with those who neither suffer much nor enjoy much because they live in the gray twilight that knows not victory nor defeat. Oh, that's Teddy Roosevelt, isn't it? You know, go for it. Go for the gusto. And many times, that's what when people think about what to do in life, we often think, I'm going to become a millionaire. I'm going to have all the pleasures. I'm going to get the American dream. But often that is just through these defective states of mind, what we call, you know, superficial happiness, contaminated happiness from a Buddhist perspective. What we can do is we can find real, deep, everlasting, peaceful happiness by training of our mind, both in just sequentially in everyday life, becoming a better person, and when you do meditation, calming your mind, going back over the events of the day, and sometimes watching this clear light nature of your mind, becoming familiar with that. That clear light nature of your mind is its conventional nature. Not its ultimate nature, but its conventional nature. His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, although it's not usually found in Buddhist texts, he said, we could call this the conventional Buddha nature. Have you ever heard that term, Buddha nature? Maybe some of you have. We all have the potential or nature to become enlightened. Because we have this clear light nature of the mind, we can remove from it all of these disturbing cloud-like or fish-like thoughts through meditation, through applying very skillful means. We can train our mind to replace the negative states of mind with positive ones. You know, altruism. Even train our mind in contentment. That almost seems like something that's not active, right? Contentment almost seems like something you get from the outside rather than you generate. Or do you generate contentment? Can you generate contentment? Yeah, we think we can. Yeah. We know we can. Certain circumstances, if we look at a situation in a different way, we're not focused on the short-term, you know, problems, we can be content. Or if we just look at our life and try to develop that state of mind, we can find a very deep kind of contentment, satisfaction. But we can go beyond that through the Buddhist path. It's not just a simple contentment, but we can increase that infinitely to experience the bliss of an enlightened state. Let me see if you've got any questions or feedback. Mr. Watkins, Dr. Watkins. He wants the microphone. Give him the floor.
So would you characterize those positive states of mind up to and including enlightenment as adventitious also?
Well,
or do they become the nature of the mind when they're achieved or realized?
Well, when we're talking about the nature of the mind, there's two natures. There's a conventional nature and an ultimate nature. The conventional nature of mind, even at enlightenment, is still this clear light nature, and its ultimate nature is what's called its emptiness of inherent existence, something a little way down the line you'll get into. So I would say that they are still, those states are still adventitious. Say for a bodhisattva, before the state of Buddhahood, these states come about, you see someone who's suffering, compassion arises adventitiously due to that, rather than resentment. Why are they suffering on my lawn? Why are you bleeding on my lawn? Get off, bleed on the street. You know, something like that. When one becomes Buddha, that's an interesting question. I think they may be continual, but they are not the nature. When you talk about the conventional nature, it's still the clear light within which they reside, and its ultimate nature is still emptiness. So I'd say that they become continual, but not they don't transform into the nature of the mind. The mind doesn't change its nature. That's my take on that. Someone else have a question? He was trying to prime the pump by asking. Yes. And remind me of your name, I forgot.
My name is Larry.
Larry.
I've read a lot. I come into that gross and subtle terminology, and I don't quite get that. Is there any way you can make that a little clearer?
Gross and subtle mind?
Yeah, or consciousness.
Consciousness, yeah. So generally, the word consciousness and mind, we can use them interchangeably. They do have slightly subtle differences, but in general, they can mean the same thing. The mind itself, if you wanted to define the mind itself, I mentioned in the earlier and perhaps in the meditation, the mind is that which is clear and knowing. Okay, the clarity of the mind, let's say the gross mind and the subtle mind, is not just like the clarity of the glass of this pitcher or the the clarity of a crystal, if you have a crystal hanging. That is something we call clear, right? Or clear water. We can use those examples. Or clear sky, you know, through which you don't see any dust or pollution or anything. The clarity of the mind is like that in a certain way, but it could also be called its ability to reflect objects. Whatever arises to a mind, whatever object impinges upon a mind, the mind can reflect an image of that, like a mirror reflects an image. And like a mirror that is clean and clear, if you polish a mirror, you take off the dust and any tarnish, if it's an old-fashioned metal mirror or something, if it's clean, you don't have to do something. The mirror doesn't have to do anything for an object to be reflected in it. Simply being in front of that mirror, an image is reflected in that mirror, right? So that's kind of the sense of clarity also. Our consciousness has that clarity. But it also, unlike physical things, it knows its object. Did I mention last time that the nature of the mind is not physical when we were talking? Yeah. The mind itself or consciousness is a impermanent phenomena, just changing moment by moment, which is not comprised of matter, and it has this nature of being clear light, as though anything that arises within it can be like the clouds or the fish of your ocean of your mind that arise within it, and it has the capacity to know or experience them, unlike a machine or a computer or something. Some years ago at a conference, I'm still going to get back to your question, but because this led me to some other areas here. At a conference called the Mind Life Conference, when the Dalai Lama was talking, one person was very excited and said he was a computer scientist and that he felt that science was at the forefront of being able to make a computer which could think, would be sentient. And the Dalai Lama said, in general, we don't believe that sentience, that life, you know, continuity of consciousness can arise. You can't just create it out of computer or something like that. But Buddhism does not discard the possibility that a consciousness could enter into a computer. You know, a consciousness that might enter into a fertilized egg. And he said, and he pointed to the person who was asking this question, saying how he was about to make computers who could think. He said, and you're creating the karma to be born in that computer. So who knows, you know. But to get back to, was it Larry? Larry's question. Gross and subtle consciousness. We'd alluded to it a little bit last time also. Gross consciousness is what we are experiencing now. Sometimes gross consciousness refers to the gross senses, the five senses, and a slightly subtler consciousness, the mental consciousness. But in general, those six consciousnesses have a similar level of gross or subtleness. There is a subtler kind of consciousness that takes place when we're about to dream. You know, science calls it the rapid eye movement, REM sleep. Have you heard of that expression? It's said that at that point, our gross consciousnesses have somewhat absorbed into the heart, not the physical heart, but what we call the heart chakra, and that a slightly subtler mind is in a dream state, having imagining visions and thinking, and someone told me at lunch today they had a dream last night or recently of the Dalai Lama, Lama Sopa Rinpoche patting them on the back as they were sobbing. They remembered in the dream. So things like that can happen in our dreams, right? Even more subtle, the subtlemost mind is this remember when I was giving this example, the core that continues from life to life, the subtle most clear light mind that doesn't think, I'm Larry, I'm Dr. Watkins, I'm George. It has within it all of the infusions of our actions, the karmic seeds, you might say, of our past deeds, past lives, and things that we're doing now. Good things, good imprints, good habits, and bad. So from a Buddhist perspective, we would like to be able to eliminate from that clear light nature the adventitious stains that are on it, these adventitious stains. In this case, they're the karmic imprints on the subtle most mind, so that in other lives, when the gross mind comes out, we'll have a gross mind that is more patient and loving and generous and content and so forth. So the right now, you could say that that our mental consciousness is a little more subtle than the gross consciousnesses, than the sense consciousnesses, when we do meditation. You know, just watching that. But we're not yet getting to a subtle level of consciousness. Yes. And you remind me, you're...
Hermond.
I thought there was a Hermond in the class. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Going back to the container, do we... If I understand well, the mind that we have is a product of previous lives. So in a sense, it is already tainted with some experiences and so the water may be darker or clearer.
Depending on how it was conditioned by our previous...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, if that is like that, I would say that we never get a purely clear water, right?
A purely clear what world?
Water.
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 Exactly. So, going back to the container of the water, the mind is really the water, not really the container. The container could be...
Yeah. Yeah, even you don't even have to think about boundaries of a container. You can think of the infinite ocean of your mind. Right. The container is not the mind. You might say the boundary is our limited minds now are bounded by our body. So somehow our mind is here now, although we can know things. You know, as our mind, even now, we could, with our eye consciousnesses, we can see things far away. We can know things at greater distances. If we develop clairvoyance, it's as though our mind, subtle aspect of our mind can expand. But I would say that it is possible to eliminate all of the conditioning that we've put in our mind. This is a Buddhist position. All of these stains are adventitious. They're not the very nature of the mind. Right now, they might seem like the nature of the mind because at one moment we're not angry, but when we meet an object of our anger or, you know, something that annoys us, anger pops up as though it was somehow in the nature of our mind to have the potential to be angry, right? That's more or less the situation right now, but that seed of anger, the predisposition to get angry, can be removed from the mind. It is the experience of great meditators, practitioners. Right now, we can apply certain simple meditative techniques as we go through Discovering Buddhism and other courses to condition our mind, to prevent those seeds from flaring up. We don't yet have the mechanism at our disposal yet to remove those adventitious seeds from our mind. I call them adventitious because they have arisen because of certain habit energy, certain events that we've done in the past, and there's a propensity to be attached or to be lonely or to be narcissistic, as someone said, or, you know, to be proud, to have low self-esteem, to feel guilty. All of these things are in our mind, but particularly dangerous one, more dangerous than those, are particularly anger, attachment, and closed-minded ignorance. We sometimes call the three poisonous minds. They're called three poisonous minds because all other deviant, you know, unhealthy kinds of minds find their source in them. Jealousy is an offshoot of attachment and anger. Resentment is a kind, is another extension of anger and so forth. Guilt, low self-esteem and so forth are extensions of bewilderment or ignorance. So these poisonous minds, the seeds of them, vary in their size, their intensity, because of conditioning in past lives. But they can eventually be removed from the mind, and you can be left with a clear ocean of mind, which is not conditioned by those, but has been, they have been replaced by positive states of mind, like altruism, the wish to alleviate suffering of others, patience, generosity, compassion, love, and especially penetrating wisdom that understands exactly what's going on. We can develop that. We know in our own lives we can develop wisdom in any one lifetime. We study and we train our mind, and the acuity of our wisdom becomes more sharp, like the edge of a sword. Right?
If I could ask another question,
sure,
in the line of the previous one. So, is the mind conscious of what clear light is, or does it have to be told what clear light is in order to pursue it?
I think of the example I gave before gives you a kind of hint. My answer to that, Herman. If you and I are at the aquarium, standing in front of the wall of glass and water behind, and you say, George, look at the clear water. I say, well, say it's right here. Here's this wall, and I just, this clear. I don't, because the water is clear, its aspect is very subtle. I have to first infer the clarity or the spaciousness of the water. It's non-obstructing nature, that it's fluid. I have to infer that by the motion of the fish. Oh, that must be like liquid in there. It's not just empty. The fish are swimming through there. Then I start to be able to infer certain qualities of that spaciousness. And this is an important one. Thank you for bringing this up. Another way of talking about the clear light nature of the mind is that it is of such a nature that it does not obstruct the arisal of thoughts within it. It doesn't sort of hold them, you know. As we start to experience that, also we recognize, even when you're angry, in one instant you can get rid of it, because it's not part and parcel of your mind. The mind is not like thick molasses where the anger is stuck there and you have to wait till it, you know, many hours for it to fall down. Then maybe that's how it seems for us a lot of times, right? It's stuck in the mind. Let me ask you this. Here's a question. Let's say this is a big boulder, and here's space. Here's empty space. Right? Space has a nature of being non-obstructing, right? I know there's space here because I can move the boulder there. Right? Okay. So right here, where the boulder is, and it's not a trick question in the sense of like talking about space between the molecules or something, where that boulder is there any space left? Or has the space now been occupied and there's no longer space there? Who wants to make a stab?
It resides within space.
It resides within space, so there's still space where the boulder is?
Yeah, it's not displaced.
The space is not displaced. That's a nice way of putting it, yeah. Anyone disagree? Do you think the space is now filled, and therefore there's no more space there? Oh, yeah, I think you agree with it. What's your name?
Michelle.
Michelle. I think Michelle's got a good idea. From a Buddhist perspective, I think that's right on. If you recognize, say, where the thoughts are, even the demon anger is in your mind, and you think, there's no space in the mind, I can't get rid of this. Like Lama Yeshe told the monk, you know, even when there's all of these airplanes of evil thoughts going through your mind or chaos, at that moment, just seeing they could not exist there unless there was space in the mind. This boulder could not be here unless there was space right there. So you can infer the clear light nature of the mind. Take your attention away from the objective thought. Replace it on the nature of the subjective mind that's knowing it. Remember, the mind is that which is clear in knowing. The knowingness of the mind is kind of its subjective aspect. Am I speaking too fast? Do you understand what I'm saying? You look a little quizzical back there, yeah?
Yeah.
So when I say subjective, what I mean by this, subject and object. The consciousness that is knowing is the subject. The thoughts that arise within it, the images or the emotional states, are like its objects. Like if we think of the mind, the clear light nature of the mind, like a big space or ocean, the thoughts or emotive states or images that are within it are like the objects. And it's not as though there's something back here where my head is looking at this. It's that the mind itself is knowing the objects within it. The mind itself is the subject, the thoughts are the objects. So if at one point we're experiencing, say, an emotive state of anger or looking at the enemy and getting uncomfortable or something, we might think there's no space in the mind. I can't get rid of that. It's like the example of the molasses before or something. Just simply recognizing this thought could not be here unless the mind was spacious. Like the example of the boulder could not be there, as Michelle said. The space is not displaced by the boulder. I like that terminology. Space is not displaced. The space is still there. The space allows the boulder to be there. So the spaciousness, the fact that a thought is in the mind, doesn't contradict the spaciousness of the mind. In fact, it reaffirms it. Subtle point. If you can get to, through meditation and familiarity, simply recognizing a thought in the mind gives you confidence the mind has this clear light nature. It couldn't be there unless the mind had clear light nature. And then you can defocus on the objective thought and refocus on this subjective clear light nature. That's what I was talking about there. Does that make a little more sense, huh? Yes, Michelle.
So while you've been talking, I took art in high school and elementary school and growing up, and a lot of times when we were studying a piece of art, or even some people might have seen certain kinds of art where it's all black and white, and if you look at the black parts of it you have one picture, and you look at the white parts of it, you have a different picture. So that to me is like that shift in what you're talking about. When you're looking at the clear light of the mind, you're looking, instead of looking at the thoughts, because they're right in front of you, you focus out beyond that, and you're staring at the negative space.
Perhaps, yeah, perhaps a little bit like that. What is that famous, was it Dürer or someone, there's black crows and in between their white...
Asher.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah, something like that. Yes. Are we okay, Robbie, for a time?
Yeah. So it seems that everything we have done in past lives or since beginningless time has been registered, like imprinted. And if so, if you become pure, can you recall the impure from past lives? Can you recall that I've killed someone in a past life? I mean, if you're pure, the pure cannot conceive of the impure, can it?
It can. It can know. It can remember. Even when we're good, when we're grown up, we can remember and feel uncomfortable about the naughty things we did when we were a kid. It said that even the Buddha, after his enlightenment, and he would talk about his previous past lives, he told about lives when he was on the path, already a spiritual path, when he was doing noble things, but he remembered things, lives when, before that, when he was more, as the Italians say, captivo, naughty. Yeah. And certainly the omniscient mind, omniscience means knowing everything. So if something happened, the Buddhist mind can remember that.
The bad ones?
The good and the bad. Yeah.
Even though the stains have been removed.
The stains have been removed, but what happened in the past already happened. Let's say, for instance, if you were to cook potatoes in an aluminum pot, boil potatoes too long, cook them for a long time, and then you take it out with a spoon, but there's still some stuck to the side of the pan, right? So you use your hand, you take out that, and then you clean it further, you put it in the water, and then you use one of those little green rubber squidgies, you know, and you get out some more stuff. And even then, there's some stain. You put in some more soap, subtler soap, hot water, and then it looks stainless. But still, if someone had a photograph of that pot 2 hours before, you'd say, "Oh yeah, I remember that had potatoes, but look at it now." You know, so the Buddha or practitioner can recognize the change in the imprints in their mind. The imprints can be gone, but they still are objects of memory.
But some holy people cannot remember their past lives.
Well, this is another story. Yeah, past lives. It's just like we say the obscuration of death. When you remember the example I gave before, the first thought of the day, if you remember the first thought of the day, you can make a jump to the last thought last night generally, right? But sometimes if you had a tough night, you can't remember the last thing you were thinking. There's a certain barrier. You can't remember every instant between the last thought of last night and today, and the first thought of today. There's a certain barrier or gap. Like that, there's a barrier or gap at the time of death, from the first thought of one life to the last thought of last night. That's the meditation I was talking about before. You can train the mind to go back, regress, over the thoughts of this lifetime. If you had perfect concentration, you could remember the past life. Nor ordinary people, you remember now the conversation. Ordinary people, we can't do this yet. It's according to this clock, it's 8:30, and I don't want to go over. I want to thank you. I think Dr. Watkins needs a couple of minutes to give you some reading assignments and some other things, so thank you very much.
Could you pass those out so everybody gets one? Thank you, Venerable George. Just a little bit of organizational material. Remind people there are four more classes in this module. There is no class Monday, November 3rd. The last class will be Monday, November 10th. The reading materials are online. Go to online learning .fpmt.org. And you'll see a section on discovering Buddhism. Go to the first module, and you'll have to set up a username and a password. And then the key to opening the first module is, appropriately, clear light. That's the password to access the first module. there's a lot of material in there, as we mentioned earlier. The required readings are labeled in there, required readings, and then also the section on the wish-fulfilling golden sun. It's on the sheet that you're getting tonight. So read all of those by the end of the course. Don't be flummoxed by the fact that the readings may not seem to have very much to do with what we talk about here. They're just to give you a little bit of parallel information and to introduce you to the styles of Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe. But they don't parallel the course material exactly. The homework for this week is to meditate 6 times for 10 minutes, 6 days out of the week. Meditate for 10 minutes on the continuity of consciousness that Venerable George talked about. Start tracing your thoughts backwards and look logically at the implications of that. The fact that you can trace them back or that you can't trace them back, just start to think about that. Start off with a little bit of breathing meditation and then go into your analytic meditation. And, yeah, so everybody, keep this. This will be the homework for the whole course will be based on this. And I think that's it. Anything you want to say? Any organizational questions? Yeah.
There were technical problems that we're working out, so we have decided for this module we will not worry about registration. Next module we'll start it.
We'll worry about it.
We'll worry about it.
Okay. Thank you, Venerable George, and thank you, everyone.